You're listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. This is a reading of Karmic Relationships, Volume 1 by Rudolf Steiner. This is Lecture 1. It is also Lecture 4, chronologically. I now wish to begin to speak to you of the laws and conditions of human destiny, which, as you know, it has become customary to describe as karma. Karma, however, cannot be seen clearly unless we are prepared to learn to know the different kinds of universal law and universal activity. Therefore, let me begin by speaking to you in a rather more abstract way of the different kinds of universal law and working, and later crystallize out, as it were, that special kind of working which can be called human destiny or karma. Both when we try to comprehend the world's phenomena, and when we wish to understand the phenomena of human life, we are wont to speak of causes and effects, in quotes. Especially in science nowadays, people are accustomed to speak quite generally of causes and effects. Yet it is precisely this habit which leads into the greatest difficulties in face of the true reality. For if we speak in this way, we are leaving out of account the variety of forms in which cause and effect actually occur in the universe. To begin with, we may observe the so-called lifeless nature, which confronts us most clearly of all in the mineral kingdom. There are the marvelous forms which often meet us in the rocks and stones of the earth. There, too, is all that appears as though it were ground down to powder and compressed again into amorphous stone. Let us consider, to begin with, all that thus appears to us as the lifeless in the world. When we consider the lifeless purely as such, we find invariably that we can seek within the lifeless itself whatever causes are at work in the lifeless realm. Wherever there is anything lifeless as an effect, there too, within the realm of the lifeless, we may look for the causes. And indeed, we only proceed according to true science if we do this, if we seek within the lifeless kingdom the causes of all lifeless processes. However beautifully formed the crystal which you have before you, you must investigate its forms within the lifeless realm. This means that the lifeless kingdom is really self-contained. We may not be able to say, to begin with, where we shall find its bounds. They may be very far away in cosmic distances. Nevertheless, whatever lifeless process or effect confronts us, if we are looking for its causes, we must seek them, once again, within the realm of the lifeless. Therewith, however, we are already placing the lifeless side by side with something else. And at once a certain perspective is opened out to us. Consider man himself, how he passes through the gate of death. All that was working and living in him before he went through the gate of death has vanished from the tangible and visible form which remains behind when the soul passes on. Indeed, we say of this human shape, which is left behind, that it is lifeless. Just as we speak of the lifeless when we look out over the rocks and mountains with their crystal forms, so must we speak of the lifeless when we behold the corpse of man, bereft of soul and spirit. And it is only from this moment that we can apply to the human body what applies to the rest of lifeless nature from the outset. For those effects which happened in and about the human form during life, before the soul had passed through the gate of death, we could not seek the causes within the lifeless realm. Not only that, when a human being lifts his arm, we shall look in vain within the lifeless physical principles of the human form for the causes of the lifting of the arm. Moreover, in the physical chemical laws which are present in the human form, we shall look equally in vain for the causes, let us say, of the heartbeat, the circulation of the blood, or any other, even involuntary, process. The moment this human form has become a corpse, however, the moment the soul has passed through the gate of death, we also observe an effect in the human body. The color changes in the skin, the limbs become inert. In short, all the effects appear that we are accustomed to witness in the corpse. Where shall we seek the cause? Within the corpse itself, in the chemical and physical lifeless laws of the corpse. Think to the end, in all directions, what I am indicating, for I am doing no more than indicate it. And you will say to yourself, as to his corpse, man, when his soul has passed through the gate of death, has become equal to lifeless nature. Henceforth we must seek the causes of the effects in the same realm, in which the effects themselves are. This is very important. But precisely when we envisage this characteristic of the human corpse, we find another very significant fact. At death, the human being, so to speak, lays aside his body. Observe with the necessary spiritual faculties what the real man, the man of soul and spirit, has now become, and you will say, the corpse has now been laid aside. For the real man of soul and spirit, having arrived beyond the gate of death, this corpse has no longer significance. It has been cast aside. For outer lifeless nature, it is quite different. Observe even superficially, and you perceive the difference. Look at a human corpse. You can observe it best where it is buried, so to speak, in the air. Certain communities used to use underground caverns as burial places, and we there find human corpses simply suspended in the air. They dry until they are completely rotten. You only need to touch them slightly, and they fall asunder into dust. The quote-unquote lifeless, which we thus obtain, is different from what we find as lifeless nature all around us. The latter contains a formative, configurative process giving rise to crystal shapes. Moreover, it is in constant change. Apart from the earthy element as such, if we observe the water and the air, which are also lifeless, we find it all in mobility and metamorphosis and transformation. Nevertheless, let this be placed before our souls at the outset. The equivalence of the human body as to its lifeless nature after the soul has laid it aside, with the lifeless world of nature outside of man. And now we may go farther. Study the plant kingdom. Here we come into the sphere of living things. Study the plant in a real way, and we shall find that we are never able to account for the effects merely from causes which lie within the plant kingdom, in the same kingdom where the effects occur. No doubt there is a science nowadays which tries to do so, but it is in a blind alley. It is at last obliged to say, quote, we can investigate the physical and also the chemical forces and laws at work in the plant. Something is then left over. Close quote. And at this point they diverge, so to speak, into two parties. On the one hand are those who say, quote, what is left over is a mere synthesis, a kind of form. The physical and chemical laws are the sole effective principle, close quote. Quote, no, say the others. There is something more, which science has not yet discovered, but it will do so, no doubt, in time, close quote. They will go on speaking like this for a long while yet, for it is not so. If we wish to make research into the plant kingdom, you cannot understand it without summoning the whole universe to your aid. You must perceive that the forces for the plant activity lie in the wide universe. All that takes place in the plant is an effect of the great universe. Before any effects can take place in plant life, the sun must come into a certain position in the universe. And other forces too must work from the wide universe to give the plant its form, its inner forces of growth, and so on. Now, if we were able, not in a Jules Verne fashion, but in reality, to travel, say, to the moon or to the sun, there too we should not be much wiser in our quest of causes than we are on earth, if we acquired no other faculties of knowledge than those we now possess. we should not reach our goal merely by saying, quote, well and good, the causes of effects occurring in the plant kingdom of the earth are not to be found in this kingdom on the earth itself. Let us, therefore, go to the sun. There we shall find the causes. Close quote. No, not at all. There, too, we shall not find them with the ordinary faculties of knowledge. We find them, however, when we work our way up to imaginative cognition. That is, when we possess quite a new faculty of knowledge. But then, we do not need to travel to the sun. We find them in the earth domain itself. Only, we have to pass from one world into another, from the everyday physical into the etheric, the ether world. In the wide universal spaces, on every hand, the cosmic ether, with its forces, is working. It works inward from the wide spaces. The ether is working in on every hand from the wide spaces. Thus, if we wish to find the causes of the effects in the plant in this kingdom, we must actually pass into a second realm of the universe. Now, man also partakes in what the plant partakes in. The forces working into the plants out of the ether world work also into man. Man carries in himself the etheric forces, and we describe the sum total of these etheric forces, which he carries within him, as the human ether body. I have already told you how the ether body goes on expanding for a few days after man's death, and how at last it loses itself, so that the human being remains over only in his astral body and his ego being. That which man carries with him etherically becomes ever larger and larger and loses itself in worldwide distances. And now once more, compare what we can see of man after his passage through the gate of death with that which we see in the plant kingdom. Of the plant kingdom, we must say, its causative forces come into the earth from the widths of space. Of the human ether body, we must say, its forces go outward into the widths of space. That is, they go whence the forces of plant growth come, as soon as man has passed through the gate of death. Here it already becomes clearer. When we observe only the physical corpse, though we recognize that it becomes lifeless, we do not find it easy to relate it to the rest of lifeless nature. When, on the other hand, we consider the living kingdom of plants, when we become aware how the causes, the forces of the plant kingdom come inward from the ether of cosmic space, then, as we enter with spiritual imagination into the human being, we perceive that with man's passage through the gate of death, the human ether body goes thither, whence come the forces, the ether forces, for the plant kingdom. Now there is yet another characteristic. The causative forces that affect the plants work comparatively quickly. The plant before yesterday's sun has little influence upon the plant as it springs from the soil or receives blossom and fruit. The day before yesterday's sun can have little effect today with all its causes. To take effect today, it must shine today. This point is important. Mark it well. You will presently see how important it is. The plants, with their etheric causes, have, it is true, their actual fundamental forces within the earthly realm, but they have them in the universe simultaneously with the earth. And when man, as a soul and spirit being, has passed through the gate of death, when the human ether body dissolves, this again lasts but a short time, only a few days. Here again you have simultaneity. For the duration of the world process, the few days are a mere trifle. Thus, when the human ether body returns to where the forces for plant growth, the ether forces, come from, we can say, as soon as man is living in the ether, his etheric activity is not restricted to the earth, for on the contrary, it leaves the earth. Nevertheless, it develops simultaneously. Hence, I may write you this scheme. Mineral kingdom, simultaneity of causes and effects within the physical. Yes, you will say, but surely the causes of some things that take place in the physical are antecedent in time. No, it is not so in reality. For any effects to arise in the physical, the causes must continue working. As soon as the causes cease working, no more effects will occur. Thus we can truly write, mineral kingdom, simultaneity of causes within the physical. And when we come into the plant kingdom, and the same will apply to the plant nature, which we can trace in man himself, there we have simultaneity in the physical and in the superphysical. So we may write, plant kingdom, simultaneity of causes in the physical and superphysical. Now let us approach the animal kingdom. In the animal kingdom, we shall investigate in vain, within the animal itself, the effects that occur during the creature's life. If it no more than crawls along in search of food, in the physical and chemical processes to be found within its body, we shall seek in vain for the causes of these effects. We shall also seek in vain in the wide ether spaces, where we find the causes for plant nature. There, too, we shall look in vain for the causes of animal movement and animal sensation. For all that is plant-like in the animal and in its processes, we shall find the causes in the etheric spaces. And when it dies, the ether body of the animal, too, goes outward into the wide universal ether. But for sensation, we shall never find the causes within the realms of the earthly physical, nor of the superphysical and etheric. We shall not find them there. Here, even more, we come to a point where the modern idea is following up a blind alley. Indeed, to some extent, it has to admit it. For many a phenomenon that occurs in the animal, all the phenomena of sensation, movement, etc., we must admit. If we investigate the physical and chemical forces within the animal, we cannot find the causes. And in the cosmic spaces, in the ether spaces of the universe, there too we cannot find the causes. If I would explain a flower, I must go out into the widths of the ether cosmos. Out of the ether universe, I shall be able to explain the flower. Likewise, I shall be able to explain many things that are plant-like in the animal. But I shall never be able to explain, even from the ether universe, that which occurs in the animal as movement and sensation. Suppose I observe an animal on the 20th of June. For its sensation processes, I shall not find the causes on the 20th of June. Not if I seek through all the realms of space within the earthly realm and beyond. And if I go farther back, there too I shall not find them, neither in May nor in April. Modern science even feels that it is so. Hence it explains some, at least, of what is thus unexplainable by referring it to, quote-unquote, heredity, that is, by a word. It is inherited. It comes down from the ancestors. Not, of course, everything, that would be too grotesque, but much of it is simply inherited. What is the meaning of this phrase? In the last resort, the concept of heredity amounts to this. All that confronts us in the animal, with all its manifold configurations, was potentially contained in the germ cell of the mother animal. Such is the effort of modern science. To study the ox externally, in the untold variety of its forms, and then to say, the ox comes from the germ cell. There were already the forces which in their full growth and development have given rise to the ox. Accordingly, the germ cell is an extremely complex body. It would indeed have to be appallingly complex, this germ cell of the ox, for it would have to contain all that presses and molds and twists and turns and works so that the tiny germ cell may become the ox with its manifold forms. However, you may twist and turn it, and there are many theories, evolution, epigenesis, and so on. However you may twist it, it comes to this. In the last resort, you must conceive the germ cell, the minute ovum, as appallingly complicated. And, where all things are referred to molecules, supposed to be built up in great complication from the atoms, some scientists are prone to represent the first rudiment of the germ cell as a complex molecule. But this, my dear friends, does not even accord with physical observation. Is the germ cell really a molecule or an organism so complicated? Its particular quality lies not at all in complication, but on the contrary, it throws all the matter back into chaos. The germ cell of all things in the mother body is not a complicated structure, but a material utterly pulverized, chaoticized. It is not organized at all. It is something that falls back into an utterly unorganized, pulverized condition. Never could reproduction take place if it were not for this. Precisely in the egg, unorganized, lifeless matter, which tends to crystalline formation, falls back into complete chaos. Albumen is not the most complicated body, but the very simplest, entirely void of inherent determination. Out of this tiny chaos, which the germ cell is, to begin with, no ox could ever arise. No, not in all eternity. For it is really chaos. Why then does it become the ox? Because at this stage, the whole universe proceeds to work upon the germ cell in the mother organism, precisely inasmuch as it has become chaos, void of determination in itself. The entire universe can work upon it. Fertilization has no other object in the world than to reduce matter again to chaos, to the indeterminate void, so that no other entity is working but the pure universe. But now if we look within the mother body, there are not the causes. If we look outside into the universal ether, there too, in what takes place simultaneously, are not the causes. We must go back before the animal came into being, if we would find the causes of what is germinating there as the beginning of a creature capable of sensation and movement. We must go back before the creature's life began. For all that is capable of sensation and movement, the world of causes lies not in the simultaneous, but before the creature's origin. If it is a plant which I observe, I must go out into the simultaneous, although in the far and wide universe. There I shall find the cause. But if I want to find the cause of all that works as sensation or capacity of movement in the animal, I can no longer go into the simultaneous universe. I must go into that which precedes the creature's life. In other words, the constellation of the stars must have become different. What influences the specifically animal nature is not the constellation in the universe simultaneous with the animal, but the constellation of the stars preceding the animal's life. Here again let us turn our thoughts to man after his passage through the gate of death. When he has passed the gate of death, when he has laid aside his ether body, which goes into the wide cosmic spaces, to every place whence come the ether forces of plant growth, man must go backward, as I have told you, until his birth. When he has done so, then he has undergone in backward progress in his astral body all that he underwent during his life. Thus, with his astral body after death, he has not to enter what is simultaneous, but he must wend his way back to the prenatal. He must go thither, whence come the forces which provide the animal with faculties of movement and sensation. They do not come from the realm of space, but from the constellations which are simultaneous. They come from the antecedent constellations of the stars. If, therefore, we are speaking of the animal kingdom, we can no longer speak of simultaneity of causes in the physical and superphysical. We must refer the present effects of the physical to past superphysical causes. Thus, for the animal kingdom, past superphysical causes present effects. Once again, we enter the concept of time. To put it trivially, we must go for a walk in time. In the physical world, when we are looking for the causes of things that happen there, we move about in the physical. We do not need to leave the physical. And if we are seeking the causes of anything that is brought about in the living kingdom of plants, we must go very far away. We must sweep through the ether world, and only where the ether world is at an end, where, as in fairy tale language, we come to the end of the world, there do we find the causes of plant growth. But we can wander there as we will. We shall not find there the causes of the faculties of sensation or of movement. To do so, we must set out on a pilgrimage in time. We must go backward in time. We must go out of space and into time. As to causation, therefore, we can place the human physical body in its lifeless condition, side by side with external lifeless nature. And we can place the human ether body, both in its life and in its outward passage after death, into the ether spaces, side by side with the etheric life of the plants. For this, too, comes in from the ether spaces, though from the simultaneous constellations, of that which is beyond the physical, above the earth. Moreover, we can relate the human astral body to the outer animal world. Now, when in further progress from mineral nature to plant and animal, we come at length to the human kingdom proper, perhaps you will say, we have already considered it. Yes, but not altogether. We have considered it inasmuch as the human being has a physical body, then inasmuch as he has an ether body, and thirdly, inasmuch as he has an astral body. But you will recognize, if man merely had his physical body, he would be a crystal, even if perhaps a very complicated one. And if, in addition, he only had his ether body, he would be a mere plant, no matter perhaps how beautiful. And if he even had the astral body added, then he would go on all fours, he would have horns or the like, in a word, he would be an animal. All this he is not. He has the form and figure he possesses as an upright, walking being, because he also possesses the ego organization, over and above the physical, etheric, and astral. To this being alone, who also has the organization of the ego, we can apply the name human kingdom. Let us observe once more what we have already seen. If we are seeking the causes for the physical, we can remain within the physical. If we are seeking the causes for plant nature, we must go out into the wide ether realms. We can still remain within space, though, as I said, this space becomes a little hypothetical, so that we have recourse to fairy-like conceptions, as when we say the end of the world, where the world is boarded up. Yet it is so. Why, even they who only think along the lines of present-day research are now beginning to divine that, in some sense, there is such a thing as the end of the world, quote, where the world is boarded up, close quote. It is, of course, a childlike and crude expression. But we need only remember the childlike way in which people are wont to think. There is the sun. It sends out its rays, on and ever on. The rays grow weaker and weaker, it is true, yet the light goes on and on, ever away, into the infinite. To those who have been at these lectures for years past, I have long ago explained what nonsense it is to imagine that the light goes on and on in this way into the endless void. Often and often I have said, the expansion of light is subject to a kind of elasticity. If you have an india rubber ball and you indent it here, you can continue pressing up to a certain point, then it springs back again. There is an end to the elastic pressure, then it recoils. It is the same for the light. It does not go on and out into the endless void. When it has reached a certain limit, it comes back again. This very idea, that the light does not go on indefinitely, but to a certain limit, whence it returns, has recently been upheld, for example, in England by the physicist Oliver Lodge. Thus, even outer science has come to the point of maintaining, in this instance, what is declared by spiritual science, as indeed in time to come it will arrive in every detail at the things which spiritual science expounds. So likewise we may say, out there, if we think our way far enough outward, sooner or later we must think back again. We must not assume a mere endless space, which is a fantasy, and moreover one which we cannot grasp. Some of you may recall what I related in my autobiography of the deep impression it made on me when I attended classes on modern synthetic geometry, and when for the first time it was shown me through geometry itself that a straight line should not be conceived as though it went out into the endless void and never ceased. The line that goes outward in this direction actually returns from the opposite side. Geometry expresses it by saying that the infinitely distant point to the right is identical with the infinitely distant point to the left. This can be found by exact calculation, not by the mere analogy of a circle, where if you set out from here you will eventually get back again to the same point. And if you then imagine the diameter infinitely long, the circle will become a straight line. That would be a mere analogy, of little or no value to one who can think exactly. I was impressed, not by this trivial analogy, but by the possibility of real arithmetical proof that the infinitely distant point on the one side, to the left, is the same as the infinitely distant point to the right. So that one who begins to run from here and runs on and on along the line will not run out into the endless void. If he only runs on for long enough, he will come back to meet us from the other side. To physical thinking it may seem grotesque. The moment we set aside physical thinking, it is a reality. The world is not endless. As a physical world, such as it lies before us here, it is limited. Once more, then, we may say, to deal with the plant nature and with the etheric nature in man, we must go to the very limits of the ether. But if we wish to explain the animal nature and the astral in man, we must go right outside all that there is in space. We must go for a walk in time, beyond all that is contemporaneous. We must move forward in time. And now we come to the human kingdom. When we thus come into time, you see, we are already transcending the physical in a twofold way. In order to describe the animal, you must move on in time. But at this stage, you must not abstractly pursue the line of thought. You must continue concretely. I beg you now, observe how we continue the line of thought concretely. People think, when the sun sends out its light, that the light goes endlessly on and on. Oliver Lodge, however, shows that this kind of thought is already beginning to be left behind. They are beginning to realize that you get to a certain limit and thence come back again. The sun receives its light sent back to it again from all directions, though in another form, in a transmuted form, still it receives it back again. Now let us apply the same kind of thought to the progression we have just followed. We stayed, to begin with, in space. Then earthly space remained there within, while we must go out into the universe. But even that was not enough. For at the next stage we go out into time. Now, someone might say, we must go on still further, on and on. No, on the contrary, now we come back again. Just as it is when we go on and on to space, we get to a limit, and thence return. So do we here come back again. Having looked in the distances of time for the past superphysical causes, we must return again, into the physical. What does this mean in reality? It signifies that out of time we must come down again onto the earth. If we would seek the causes that apply to man as such, we must seek them once more on earth. Only, we have gone backward in time, and I need hardly say, when going backward in time we come again onto the earth. We come into a former life of man. We come into a former life. For the animal, we have to go on and on. It dissolves away in time, just as our ether body dissolves away to the utmost limits. Man at this point does not dissolve away. We must come back again, even into his former life on earth. Therefore, in man's case, we can say, past physical causes for present effects within the physical. Schema, mineral kingdom, simultaneity of causes within the physical. plant kingdom, simultaneity of causes in the physical and superphysical. Animal kingdom, past superphysical causes corresponding to present effects. Human kingdom, past physical causes corresponding to present effects in the physical. You see, it has cost us some pains today, by way of preparation, to enter into these abstractions, but that was necessary. I wanted to show you that there is also a logic for these realms, the really spiritual realms of life. This logic is only not coincident with the crude logic which is merely abstracted from physical phenomena, and in which alone people will commonly believe. Proceeding purely logically, investigating all the series of causes, even in the pure course of thought, we came to the repeated lives of man on earth. We need to be attentive to this fact. Our thought itself must become different if we would apprehend the spiritual. People imagine that one cannot understand what is revealed out of the spiritual world. One can, indeed, but one must extend one's logic. After all, even to understand a piece of music or any other work of art, you must have in you the conditions to go out to meet it. If you have not the conditions, you will pass by it without appreciation, as a mere noise. If it is music, or if it is plastic art, you will see nothing in it, quote-unquote, but the crude, obvious forms. And so, for the communications from the spiritual world, you must meet them with a thinking adequate to the spiritual world. And this can already be found in pure logical thinking. Seek out the possible varieties of causes, and you can actually come to understand repeated earthly lives, even in logical consequence. Now we remain with the great question which is opened up when we consider the corpse. The corpse has become lifeless. External, lifeless nature stands there before us in its crystals and manifold formations. Here the great question arises, how is lifeless nature related to the corpse of man? Perhaps you will find that it will lead you on a little in a direction tending toward the answer, if you first seize the matter at the second stage. Say to yourselves, I look at the world of plants around me. Out of the wide spaces of the ether universe, it bears within it the forces to which my own ether body returns. Away, up yonder, in the ether spaces, is the causative principle which gives the plants their origin. There is the realm to which my ether body goes when it has served my life. Thither I go, whence from the ether spaces all the life of plants wells forth. Thither I go. That is, I am akin to it. In fact, I can even say, something is there up yonder, thither my ether body goes. Thence comes the greening, springing, sprouting world of plants. Yet there is a difference. I give up my etheric body. The plants, on the other hand, receive the ether for their life and growth. I, after my death, give my ether body away, give it away as a thing that is left behind. They, on the other hand, the plants, receive this ether body as that which gives them life. They have their beginning from yonder realm whither I go with my ending. The plant's beginning joins together with the human ether body's ending. This will bring near to you the question, might it not also be so for the mineral, for all the manifold crystal formations? Might I not ask, perhaps this too is a beginning, in contrast to the ending which of myself I leave behind as the physical corpse. Perhaps here too, beginning and ending are joined together? With this question we will close for today, my dear friends. Tomorrow we shall begin to enter quite thoroughly the question of human destiny, so-called karma. I shall continue about karma. You will no longer have to find your way through such a jungle of abstractions. But you will also perceive that for a certain unfolding of thought, this was unnecessary preparation. The end of Lecture 1.